no surprise that newsmakers try to manipulate the audience. They want you to believe that they are the one holding the line, and they'll use any trick they can to get you there. But don't let them fool you. Get unspun. I'm Amanda Sturgill. I've been a reporter, and today I teach future reporters to cut the spin and think critically about what newsmakers say. My podcast, Unspun, shows you how to know when you're being manipulated by the news. Learn to spot the tricks and how to make up your own mind about what's true. So if you're tired of being fooled by the news, subscribe to Unspun today. Unspun, because you deserve the truth.
MSW Media.
Spy Talk, a podcast at the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, national security, and military operations.
Hi, I'm Michael Isikoff, and this is Spy Talk.
August the 31st, 2001, was a clear day in the village of Astani in the Panjshir Valley. Commander Massoud boards a helicopter that takes him over the Hindu Kush mountains to his northern field headquarters at the village of Khoja Bahuddin in Taka province. Also in Khoja Bahuddin at the same time were two alleged Tunisian journalists called Abdesattar Damani and Bouhari El-Weir, who were patiently waiting to interview Massoud on behalf of a TV station in the UAE. It later turned out that this TV station did not exist, and that these men were actually assassins.
That's a clip of a documentary about a seismic event that took place 24 years ago this week. The assassination of Ahmad Shah Massoud, the Lion of Panjshir, who led the Northern Alliance fight against the Taliban. The murder of Massoud by two Islamic militants posing as journalists was enormously consequential for Afghanistan and the United States. It was, from all accounts, part and parcel of an elaborate operation that culminated 2 days later, the attacks on the World Trade Towers and the Pentagon by Al-Qaeda on September 11th, 2001. But the assassination was most consequential of all for Ahmad Massoud, the son of the Northern Alliance leader, who was 12 years old at the time. Today, he is the leader of the Northern Resistance Front of Afghanistan, a guerrilla army that is fighting to topple the Taliban regime. How much support his army has inside Afghanistan is open to question, but he has some provocative things to say about his hopes for the future of his country and who was really behind his father's assassination. And then we'll hear another perspective from John Lee Anderson, the esteemed foreign correspondent from The New Yorker. He spent years reporting on these matters, and he too has some fascinating things to say about the Massoud assassination on this special all-Afghanistan edition of Spy Talk. Okay, we are now joined by Ahmad Massoud, the leader of the National Resistance Front in Afghanistan. Ahmad, welcome to Spy Talk.
Thank you so much for having me, Michael. It's an honor.
It's a pleasure to have you. And can I say where you are speaking to us from?
Well, somewhere close to Afghanistan.
Okay.
Unfortunately, not inside, but maybe soon, inshallah.
An undisclosed location in Central Asia. So look, a lot we want to talk about, and I know this is a very emotional week for you, but I just want to start out with the horrific news out of Afghanistan this week about the earthquake. I think the death toll is now over 1,400, more than 3,000 people wounded. Pleas for international aid from the Taliban. Tell us first what you know about what has happened as a result of the earthquake and conditions on the ground there, and what you make of the pleas from the Taliban for humanitarian assistance for the victims.
Thank you very much. Well, as you rightly said, unfortunately, it was a horrific accident and incident that unfortunately this earthquake caused so much pain to some amazing people in a very sort of secluded area of Afghanistan, an area that the people, they were living in their houses with little to almost no sort of access to any anything to enable them to prevent such thing, or to enable them to empower them in a way to have, like, you know, stronger houses or foundation or whatever. So and all of that, it occurred. That's why when you hear, like, a nice, you know, sort of like a nice 6 point, like, you know, earthquake, it's not that strong. But unfortunately, because of the situation of the people in that area, and the lack of the resources they received and throughout their life, unfortunately, their household, it was the foundation was weak, and that catastrophe happened. It was a huge tragedy. In terms of international aid, I'm hearing a lot of very good things from UAE to other countries, which are showing some sign of support. But the issue is, just like about 2 years ago, we had another awful earthquake at that time in Herat, province of Afghanistan, that hundreds of people, they got killed, and hundreds of houses, it was lost. The experience at that time was the distribution of aid, it was being disrupted by the Taliban, and unfortunately, it wasn't being reached to the people properly. And I hope that the Taliban to grow some decency, to be able to, you know, to serve people. And because this is the thing that at that time, and at this time, I cannot use sort of the this rivalry, this conflict that we have with the Taliban for me to in here to come and, like, and sort of to make, like, you know, just bad points about the Taliban, because I need to put even, like, you know, that conflict over, because this tragedy is so big that it requires attention of all. So therefore, I just hope for them to grow some decency, not to disrupt the international aid for them, for allow it to get to the people. I hope so. But unfortunately, the past experiences showed that without a proper government to properly serve its people, such catastrophes going to keep happening in Afghanistan, is going to keep so many, is going to get so many lives.
Well, we're going to get into, of course, the activities of the National Resistance Front, but you are waging a guerrilla campaign to topple the Taliban in light of this humanitarian disaster. Are you putting a pause on your military operations against the Taliban?
As I just mentioned to you, this is a tragedy that it is very grave, and indeed we have put a pause. Unfortunately, last night, despite all the pause, and the Taliban have actually attacked our people, and that created a conflict, and we had to, you know, fight back, and we lost a member of the NRF forces, a great figure who unfortunately we lost it in the war yesterday in the fight. But it
where,
is the
where was that? Where was
it
that?
It was at this time. It was in Baghlan. It was in one of the northern districts and provinces of Afghanistan. But mm-hmm. the earthquake, it happened in the eastern, southeast of Afghanistan. So we put some pauses in our conflict due to some circumstances and in such conflict, or some, like, you know, sort of celebrations that we have throughout the year. But the Taliban, unfortunately, they seem to not care about the people and how they are at all.
So just to be clear here, you declared after the earthquake a ceasefire in your military operations. And if you, is that the case?
Of course, I put all our activities on hold because of such, you know, disastrous incident in Afghanistan.
And
but in that area particularly.
In eastern Afghanistan, where the earthquake was. Okay. Well, I obviously want to dig into the situation on the ground in Afghanistan. But let's start out. This is the first week in September. It is the anniversary of 24 years ago. The assassination of your father, the leader of the Northern Alliance that was fighting the Taliban. And this took place just a couple of days before the 9/11 attacks. You were 12 years old at the time. Tell us where you were and how you learned what happened to your father.
At that time, I was in Prankshire Valley. I was, still I remember, I was in my grandmother's house. But, all of a sudden I felt unease. I felt very anxious. And my grandmother assured me that nothing happened, although for whatever reason, without knowing, I felt anxious. And then later, about like a couple of hours later, I saw the head of Panjshir intelligence chief. He came to visit my grandfather, and they were speaking in a room. It was private, but I could see through the window that the way they were behaving, it was in a very sort of a panicking way. And I knew something did happen. And all of a sudden, they asked us that commander requested the whole family to go to Tajikistan, which was very not so him. It was so different. And we knew something happened because we recently, went back to Panjshir Valley, and we knew something happened. And they couldn't hide it anymore. And they told us that commander just got injured because they wanted to slowly, prepare us for that tragic news and prepare the whole nation for such tragic news. But still, I remember, Michael, a very sort of a beautiful sentence that my father told me and my mother told me. My mother, after hearing that my father was injured, she just sat down and the tears was coming. And she just said, your dad doesn't get injured. He's gone. That's all she said. And she was just silent. She was not like crying loud. She was just weeping and the tears was coming. But she knew that whoever approached my father, it's not going to be just a small injury. It's going to be a devastating blow. And it was unfortunately true.
Now, as has been and as was widely reported at the time, the assassins were two Tunisians with, I believe, Belgium passports who purported to be journalists and wanted to interview your father. Your father didn't know them. He had to fly, I believe, by helicopter to meet them for this interview. Why did he go at all?
Well, the thing is, it was a very malicious plan, Michael, and it was very well prepared. The mastermind of the attack, it was Ayman al-Zawahiri and Osama bin Laden. And at that time, the ISI of Pakistan. And Ayman al-Zawahiri and Osama bin Laden, when they were planning this, simultaneously they were planning for 9/11 too. That is why my father's assassination, in planning and purpose, they are linked to 9/11. And one of the person who recruited these two terrorists, he was an imam, and he was this extremist scholar in London. And the recruitment happened in Belgium of two Arab Tunisians and with Belgian passports. They were recruited in Belgium, which is still Belgium is one of the epicenter of these extremist groups. Let's not forget that still they do exist over there, and there are some fanatics. They still exist there, and they went to Pakistan and they got all their equipments in Pakistan, the cameras and the batteries and everything, which most of them they had hidden bombs in it. And then, even except just maybe one or two members of the Taliban, majority of the Taliban even didn't know about this plan, because they carried it out in complete secrecy, even without telling the Taliban, letting them know. They passed it through the Taliban territory. They got it into our territory, and they waited in our territory and posing as journalists for almost a month or two, I think. They waited, and my father didn't have time to meet them. On the very last day that they actually communicated with their sponsor in London, which was that imam, that we couldn't meet Masood, and we are tired, we are going to come back. On the very last day, my father's sort of media guy, he was forcing my father, asking him and insisting that, please, these are Arab journalists and we need to let the Arab world know and Arab nations know what's happening in Afghanistan and what Al-Qaeda is doing. So you need to let them know what's happening and do this interview. And unfortunately, he agreed and he went in that room and the rest is history.
What is your evidence that the ISI was behind this plot?
Well, it was something that I heard at that time. And it was something that many of the leaders of our community, they were implying. And the fact that the bombs were being made and given to them in Pakistan, it indicates how the ISI wouldn't know about such plan being carried out and all of them coming and getting their passports and getting their sort of their bombs and everything ready without the ISI knowing.
I have to say, though, your account of how they had been trying to get this interview for some weeks before does take away a little bit of the coincidence of the timing, that the assassination took place just 2 days before 9/11. That's what most people looked at and said, they are obviously linked. But if these two Arab supposed journalists were trying to do this for weeks prior, that does maybe take away from the argument that this was part of the 9/11 operation.
The thing is, once again, Michael, I didn't mention about the timing of it. I mentioned about planning and purpose. It doesn't matter if it was months before or years before. You cannot take away the planning and purpose away from it. Who carried out it and who planned it? Ayman al-Zawahiri and Osama bin Laden. And why they did it, it's important for your audience to know. Because they realized they cannot militarily defeat Ahmad Shah Massoud. And they wanted to bring, this is actually something which even the Al-Qaeda, they confessed to this, that they wanted to bring America to the mountains of Afghanistan to make them bleed. This is what they said. We need to bring them to Afghanistan. This is an absolute desperation move to bring them to Afghanistan, to mountain, to make them bleed. And however, as long as Ahmad Shah Massoud is alive, this cooperation and partnership is too strong. It's going to be devastating. So therefore, what is left for us is we need to kill Ahmad Shah Massoud first to assassinate him. And then to bring America, by such attack, because they knew the result is going to be Americans' reaction to them in Afghanistan and to continue as a so-called jihad. And this is why, this is the purpose and the purpose and planning, they are linked.
Was your father receiving any backing from the CIA or foreign intelligence services?
No, unfortunately. Otherwise, my father would be able to capture the whole Afghanistan with sufficient support. Unfortunately, just like myself, he was facing a lot of logistic and a lack of logistic support and lack of funding support.
Had he received support from the CIA in the past, and did they stop it? Or it would seem, given the Taliban's role at the time in protecting Al-Qaeda, that the United States would have had an interest in backing your father's efforts.
Absolutely. Just the way that right now the Democratic Force of Afghanistan do possess a role and do actually sort of, I believe, in my opinion, just like how you stated, that they need that support, and America can play a role in that at that time also. But until the attack happened, they didn't realize that importance, and they didn't provide anything.
You are going to be speaking at the Global Security Conference next week in New York, sponsored by the Soufan Center. It takes place just a couple blocks away from the World Trade Towers, the site of the 9/11 attack. Tell us a little bit about what you plan to say to that very distinguished audience.
Of course. Well, I don't want to spoil it in here to say the whole thing, but basically, it is important for for the people to know what's happening in Afghanistan, because in this chaos of the world that we are living in, and so much geopolitical games and conflicts and problems that's and concerns that's going on, Afghanistan is forgetting, keeps being forgotten. So it is important to bring it to the map, to the attention, and to let them know how in the darkness the evil is actually regrouping and re-strengthening itself. And we have evidence of such things that's happening. For example, the latest remarks of Mr. Shoigu from Russia. And it is not me, it is not Ahmad Massoud, it is someone who actually recently recognized the Taliban as a legitimate state.
Who is it you're referring to?
Mr. Shoigu. Shoigu from Russia.
Okay.
The director of the national security.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And he said that there are 23,000 foreign terrorists right now in Afghanistan. 23,000, 24,000, he said. So don't take it from me, take it from him. And so it just shows that they are very much active and alive, and they are many, many times more terrorist groups and terrorists and people and fundamentalists and extremists in Afghanistan now than they were in the 90s.
Well, Russia, of course, is the one country in the world that has recognized the Taliban government. Yeah. So when they talk about foreign terrorists, he's probably including you and your forces.
No, it is. The thing is, when we are group that we are fighting for freedom, and we are fighting.
Well, I know, but I'm giving this. Yeah. This is coming from a government that is backing the very government you're trying to topple.
Well, I doubt that they mean by terrorist groups and us. I strongly believe that they mean the foreign terrorists who are right now in Afghanistan. And I believe even to Russian, they understand and they can differentiate between those who are actually fighting for for the liberation and the sovereignty of their country and those who are there for terrorist purposes.
The big question that people have about the National Resistance Front and your efforts is just how much support you have inside Afghanistan. How large is your military force? How many operations you're able to carry out, and whether there is underlying public support. So tell us what you can. First, about the state of the National Resistance Front. How many soldiers do you have in how many provinces? How many attacks are you able to carry out? And, the ultimate question is, how much support do you actually have inside the country?
Well, in National Resistance Front, I can start with, because I need to be very careful with the figures and also the information that I give, because it is important to safeguard the people who are fighting for their dignity in Afghanistan. We have sufficient men to fight another cause. We have active in thousands, almost to 5,000 who are active, who are inside Afghanistan. They're ready to operate any second. And we have tens of thousands in reserve, which we do not have any sort of logistic capability at the moment to mobilize them. However, unfortunately, in front of us, there is a group that is very much enjoying, and they have the luxury of being able to do whatever they want with the internal income of Afghanistan, the international aid, and there were billions of dollars of American equipment left at their disposal because of a very bad withdrawal of in Afghanistan, and also the narcotic money that is still is coming to them. Alongside these thousands and thousands of terrorist groups and regional and international terrorist groups alongside them. So when we are fighting against such well-equipped, well-funded, and also have all these terrorist groups, so we needed to adopt a guerrilla style tactic. However, on the political side, we managed to gain much more than our military side, because the military side, it requires, as you know, war is money. And unfortunately, that's something we lack. And therefore, we have that guerrilla tactic. But on political side, we have gained a lot. The Taliban could not get any internal recognition. The opposition are very much united, more than ever. And also, the Taliban could not get any important political figure who are not Taliban member from outside Afghanistan or inside Afghanistan to promote the Taliban or legitimizing the Taliban or give his blessing. So therefore, the Taliban, and also they lack any roadmap. They couldn't provide any roadmap in the past 4 years to say, okay, this is what we want. For example, Michael, imagine or know like what's happening in Syria. One thing which, with all the sort of evilish background that, or like in a very dark background that Ahmad al-Sharr had, but the moment he came, he made some right choices. And he did some good steps, for example, by calling for national dialogue, announcing an election in 5 years, providing a roadmap. And that created, I believe, an internal trust, while the Taliban lacked any of that. However, on the other hand, the opposition, including the NRF, National Resistance Front, we have our political goal and we have our roadmap published, and we had 5 rounds of democratic talks in Vienna with all other sort of groups, and we are on the verge of creating that alternative. Unfortunately, because of these geopolitical games that's going on, the only thing we are lacking as of now, it is the support, which sooner or later is going to come.
You say we're on the verge of creating what? What is it that you're...
An alternative.
Seeking to create, this is an opposition group that cuts across multiple lines. Tell us what we're talking about. Are you talking about an exile government, a government in exile? What are you?
I don't want to spoil
seeking
it,
to
but
proclaim here.
That is something that we are aiming at. Yes. And a government in exile, and also a more united front, a more united opposition, and a more cohesive team to work together. And we needed sometimes to figure all these things out, and we are very close to achieving that. Yes,
there's another resistance group fighting. I think it's called the Freedom Front or
Freedom Front. Yes.
Yeah, are they part of your coalition that would join this government in exile?
They are a very competent and good group, and I'm in touch with their leader, Mr. Zia, who was a former member of Afghanistan Army, and he was the chief of staff of Afghanistan at one point, and he's a very credible, competent person, and I respect him a lot. And we are in complete cooperation with each other, and we have met many times. And I can say that there are many groups just like us that who are standing against the Taliban day by day. And every day that's passing, and we are rising, and we are growing. And yes, we are in talk, and he is, and they are a part of the talk that we have for a more cooperation and unity among the opposition.
How soon do you think you'll be able to announce this government in exile? And will you be the head of it?
No. The thing is, who's going to be the head of that? It's something that depends on that unity that we can create. However, one thing is that about the timing, if it's that sort of the format of it, is it a government in exile or it is any other sort of system or way, it's something that is still talks are going on. But we are very close to that. But the timing, I cannot give a timing as of now.
Okay. You said before that you have nearly 5,000 soldiers as part of the resistance front. How many attacks have you been able to carry out, operations have you been able to carry out over the past year?
Past year, we had more than 900 attacks across Afghanistan, which even the UN report, also verified most of those attacks that we did. And also we are adapting, and we are evolving, and we are learning more and more and newer ways to cause the maximum damage and to get the maximum results, and to let the Taliban know either they are ready to come to the table to talk in negotiation, and they are ready to accept for people to decide their own fate and future. Because, Michael, let's not forget the most important factor, why we are fighting. I'm not fighting for Ahmad Massoud to be the president. I'm not fighting for National Resistance Front to rule the country. I'm fighting so the people of Afghanistan can rule. That's my ultimate goal. if the Taliban announced today that they are ready for an election under the watch of UN, tonight I'm going to announce the end of the resistance. And we are going to join that political journey. All we are doing is, I believe, as Afghans, we deserve, just like any other human being across the world, to decide our own fate and future. This is the bare minimum. We deserve such life and such dignified life, which Taliban stripped away from my people. And for that, people need to decide their own fate and future. This is why we are fighting.
How many provinces are you active in?
21 provinces, as of now.
21, okay. Over the past year, this situation inside Afghanistan has only gone from bad to even worse, particularly the restrictions on women can't go to school after the sixth grade, need to be accompanied by a male guardian if they go outside, the morality police requiring them to be completely covered. Has this led to more support for your efforts, or are things just so shut down and controlled in Afghanistan that it's impossible to know at this point?
Well, the support from the people, it has been enormous. And let's not forget, Michael, that in the past 4 years, we have been continuing our work solely on the support of my people. There has been no support from outside whatsoever.
Right. Well, certainly not the United States under the Biden administration. When they were asked, they very clearly said there should be, we do not support organized violent opposition to the Taliban. Have you had any contact at all or seen any budge from that under the Trump administration?
Well, you rightly mentioned about the previous administration, what was unfortunately their agenda and their sort of stance. However, with the current administration, I believe still they are very much busy with other issues and finalizing their policies from Ukraine to Iran and Taiwan and many other sorts of big concerns around the globe. So therefore, we are hopeful and we're still waiting to see what is the policy and how it's shaping and what's the Washington's policy regarding Afghanistan. I hope for it to be better than what it was with the previous administration.
But you've had no contact and no signals
myself
at all.
Myself personally, no.
Right, right. But you were, there was a Republican Congressman, Tim Burchett, I believe, who last year invited you to come to the United States, to Washington and speak. But you haven't. Why not? Can you get a visa? Why don't you come to the United States?
First and foremost, Tim and Senator Tim is like he's a wonderful figure, wonderful person who has been one of the amazing noble men that I know, and he has been supporting the Afghan cause, and he has been supporting democracy for Afghanistan for so long, and alongside the veteran community, they have been amazing in terms of support for Afghanistan. However, why it was, because unfortunately at that time the timing was not right for me to do it. I was extremely busy at that time, and unfortunately I was also location was not able to do it, and I have not applied to know if the visa and getting it was possible or not, so therefore in that area also I don't know. However, at that time also I knew that America was on a sort of a transition from previous administration to current one. It was the election time, so my voice would be gone in the middle of all those sort of campaigns and election time. So I waited for it to be at the right time for the world to hear it, and especially for American people in Congress.
So is that still an active issue? Does the invitation still hold? Are you still hoping to come to Washington and make your case?
Of course. And I'm willing to come, and I'm willing to speak at Congress or Senate and about situation in Afghanistan and to meet any officials, because the thing is, I believe the world needs to pay attention to Afghanistan Let's not forget, Michael, there was a time that, unfortunately, because of these geopolitical games, they ignored Afghanistan. And look what happened. Same thing is happening right now. And when the world is busy with other concerns and issues, the evil is strengthening in Afghanistan. And it's something that I don't say it. All evidence, it points in that direction.
Are you able to go into Afghanistan now?
I can, but it at a great cost. So therefore, it is up to my military committee to sort of decide and prepare the situation. And the guerrilla warfare tactic, Michael, it requires a different tactic. So therefore, just for my protection, they had to, you know, exhaust a lot of their resources. So therefore, it is better, you know, for me to, you know, to be a little far than, like, you know, exhaust all their expenses and their resources on protecting me instead of doing their job.
When's the last time you were in Afghanistan?
Unfortunately, I cannot say that.
Okay.
But it has been, unfortunately, a couple of years.
Right. But since the Taliban took over?
No, I've been after that, but like, you know, not very recent.
And just to wrap up here, obviously, you know, the Taliban has, you know, tightened its control over the population in Afghanistan. There's, you know, even before the earthquake, there was malnutrition. I think that UNICEF had estimated 3.5 million children under the age of 5 are malnourished. How much hope do you have right now that Afghanistan will be free of the Taliban?
I am as hopeful, Michael, that I'm as hopeful as I can be. Like, you know, as much as I can be, I cannot be more hopeful than I am right now. Because I know two things. First, Afghans are very resilient. They do not give in very easily. Second, in the past 40, 50 years, we had many, many governments that came and go, including the Republic, and many regimes, they came that they were supported by great powers and they couldn't continue. Whoever doesn't have the support of people, they're going to fall. And Taliban certainly do not have the support of people. They will fall. That I'm sure of. That I'm 100% sure of. And this is why what I want is a dignity for all Afghans. Even Michael, if the Taliban actually knew what I want and actually listened, what I want for future of my country is something which is for the benefit of even the Taliban. But what they want, I know, for themselves, it's short term. It is tactical. It's something that sooner or later they are going to lose it. And they have nowhere to go this time. Because they, all their sanctuaries, either it's gone or their sanctuary, it's no longer as giving them the signal that they're going to receive the world next time.
Right. Ahmed Massoud, I want to thank you for
thank you so much,
the interview. I will be at the Safan Center conference watching you, I guess, on some big screen where you'll be delivering your message. Thank you.
It was a pleasure, Michael. Thank you so much, sir.
Okay.
Thank you very much. God bless you guys. Thank you.
Yes, you too. Now we'll take a quick break before we come back with another perspective from John Lee Anderson, the foreign correspondent for The New Yorker, who has spent years reporting on Afghanistan. And we're back. Okay, we are now joined by John Lee Anderson, distinguished foreign correspondent for The New Yorker and author of the news book, To Lose a War, The Fall and Rise of the Taliban. John, welcome to Spy Talk.
Thanks, Mike.
You are, being the roving foreign correspondent you are, you're coming to us from Nairobi, you know, I'm sure headed to even more adventures. So I want to talk to you. At first, congrats on the book. It is a compilation of the amazing reporting you've done in Afghanistan over the years. But we just had an interview with Ahmed Massoud, leader of the National Resistance Front, and also son of Ahmed Shah Massoud, the leader of the Northern Alliance, who, of course, was assassinated 24 years ago this week on the eve of the 9/11 attacks. And I wanted to sort of get a reality check from you on what conditions are in Afghanistan today. We've, of course, have the horrible news about the earthquake there.
Yeah.
1,400 people killed. Yet more. This is a country already facing quite a humanitarian disaster, even before this earthquake.
Yeah, they just don't get a break. Yeah.
Just to start out, Ahmed, you know, the Taliban, there's been a lot of news about the Taliban and the they have turned out to be every bit as controlling and policies, you know, horrifically anti-women. Women can't go to school after sixth grade now. They have to be accompanied by male guardians on the streets. What is your sense of the state of the Taliban today, how much they are in control of the country, how much opposition there actually is to their rule?
Thanks. Yeah, thanks, Mike. First of all, I just want to say, wow, Ahmed Massoud, the last time I saw him, he was 13 years old, and he was unveiling, I think, something, maybe he was 15, and he was there for the unveiling of his father's mausoleum a year after his death. So here we are 24 years later, anyway. And he was just a kid, you know. Look, the national resistance doesn't exist. That is to say, it exists in name, just as it did, I guess, 25 years ago, you know, when 9/11 happened and Ahmed Shah Massoud was killed 2 days before the attacks on the on New York and Washington. He controlled about 5% of Afghan territory. There had been a losing battle ever since the Taliban had taken over in 96 to 2001, successive waves of Al-Qaeda assisted as well. Attacks which had rolled back the former government, mostly ethnic Tajik, the Taliban being ethnic Pashtuns, mostly from the south. He was clinging on to a tiny little wafer of Afghan territory along the Tajik border, where I think his son is today. And that's where the United States came in with the CIA and others, and with the help of warlords in the north, you know, started rolling the Taliban back, and the help of B-52s as well. And here we are. Taliban are back in power. There is really no resistance. In fairness and in recognition of their courage, of the Panjshiris, that is to say the valley just to the north of Kabul, in the Hindu Kush, where Massoud, his father, held strong against the Soviets all those years in the 80s. And then again in the 90s, this kind of losing battle until he was killed. This fastness where the family and that clan hold strong, they did rally. They were the only part of the country that really rallied in armed resistance to the Taliban in 2021 when they rolled through everywhere. And that was quickly quashed. I think they lasted it several weeks. No doubt there are Tajiks, Panjshiris, you know, people like of Massoud's clan and others who would like to see it differently, but for the moment, they have no real turf to fight from. So the Taliban, you know, as you pointed out, they have the earthquake. There is this, here is a country that they've inherited, which has doubled in population in the years they were out of power. It went from a country of 20-odd million to 40-odd million. So the average age of the average Afghan is about 18 and a half years old. The city of Kabul was about a million, maybe some, and change people when I saw it in 2001, destroyed. It's now a city of, you know, 5 or 6 million. It's a modern city in the Afghan context. These people, for the by and large, the Taliban had spent their entire lives in the bush, you know, in the mountains. Many of them had never been in a town before, much less a city. And here they are now, 4 years later, controlling the lives of not only the city, the people of the capital, but the entire country. And in a sense, they've brought the entire country, or the country is at the, is at their level at this point. They have a supreme leader who sits in Kandahar, is rarely ever seen in public, who of something like Khomeini in his day in Iran, you know, or Mullah Omar back in the days of the first Taliban, right, decrees things from Kandahar, and it's the law of the land. Women will now not speak in public. That's the last decree when it came to women. You know, so
not speak in public at all. You cannot
at all. Their voices,
even if you're a company.
No. Their voices may not be heard.
This is an official decree from
this is an official government. Decree by the supreme leader. So it's made up of, it's not monolithic. You know, as we tend to find out, most revolutionary movements are not. Neither is the Taliban. You have the old Taliban. These are the kind of imams in the south, somewhat rustic, you know, these who have their own interpretation, which I would regard as, how should we put this, somewhat primitive of the Quran, you know, when it comes to human rights, rights of women, and so on. These are even worse than the Saudis in their worst days. And when it comes to women. Now, the Taliban have explanations for this. They say, well, we've taken these, you know, these because the people were poisoned by the West. There's libertine behavior and we have to protect women. At a certain time, we will begin to free them up. So this is what you tend to get by Taliban representatives in Kabul, the capital. So there's the old capital, the old royal capital of Afghanistan, which is Kandahar in the south, where the Taliban have always been strong. And then Kabul in the center, which has periodically been a modern city, and now it's under the Taliban again. And there you have those who are strong there are out of the Haqqani network. Now, this is a separate group that did an alliance years ago with Al-Qaeda and thence with the Taliban to oust the Americans, essentially. And in since the conquest of Afghanistan in 2021, the Haqqani family in particular, they were the son of the former jihadi leader who brought Osama bin Laden to Afghanistan, is now the interior minister. And he has let it be known that he would like a different relationship with the West. He has made all of the overtures, all of the signals necessary to suggest that he represents a more moderate faction within the Taliban. However, at the same time, I've spoken to people who know him and close to him, in which he says he's not going to get into an internecine fight with the imams in the south. In other words, what's more important to the Taliban right now, today, and for the foreseeable future, is essentially force protection. They're going to consolidate power within the borders of that country rather than get into a struggle between factions. That's their intention anyway. So, but they've been entirely cut off from international aid. Not only is the earthquake, they have about 5 million Afghans returning forcibly from Iran and Pakistan. Mm-hmm. The governments of these two neighboring countries just decided to kick out the Afghans they have there, millions of which have been there for refugees. Some were born there. So these people piling back into this country, which doubled in size and now has no economy. And it's not a good look. The only diplomatic recognition the Taliban government have 4 years on was the first one came from Putin's government, Russia, in July.
Right.
And just a few weeks ago, the foreign minister of China, came to Kabul. And of course, the Qataris are these sort of interesting brokers in the region and are somehow the intermediary for the Taliban.
But the Chinese haven't recognized the Taliban, have they?
The
Chinese recognized? Not yet. Right.
No, they have not. But some Chinese companies have done some mining concession deals.
Okay.
Yeah.
I guess Ahmed Massoud says he's working with opposition groups and they hope soon to announce some sort of government in exile, would be a coalition of resistance groups. I mean, is this just a pipe dream? Is there any prospect that opposition to what is a really, totalitarian regime, at least for women. Is there a path for people to oppose this?
It almost sounds like you're asking if the Democratic Party in the United States can muster an opposition to Trump. I mean, in a sense, we're talking, yeah. It's an analogous situation or an analogous limbo. It's not visible at the moment.
Yeah.
You know, it's not visible at the moment. They seem to have all the power. They have all the guns. It's their war to lose. It's their turf to lose, I should say, because there's no war. Mm-hmm. For the first time since 1978, Afghanistan is actually not a shooting gallery. And that's not a bad thing. So in some sense, it has to be said that in some ways, this is the first time Afghan society has been at least not subjected to bombings and raids and airstrikes. So that's not a bad thing. The Taliban have in their wherewithal to do something with this peace if they wish to. And let's see what they do. And let's see whether administrations in the West.
Some would argue we're seeing what they do, and none of it is good. I mean,
That's right.
Controls on women seem to be getting tighter and tighter.
Right. And remember, NATO fought there and lost. Not the United States fought there and lost. And the Americans and most countries that lose wars tend not to try to look back at their failures for a period of time. How long was it before? Was it Clinton that made peace and brokered diplomatic rapprochement with Vietnam? Was it 20 years later?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't know how soon. I you know, look, Afghanistan's sitting on, they calculate $3 trillion worth of minerals, which include all the good ones, you know, that Trump would like. So it's not beyond the realm of possibility that we could see, I don't know, is there another father-in-law out there of one of his kids who he might become, a mediator or a peace broker or to go there and do some deal with the Taliban in return for some
minerals
deal?
Talking another father-in-law of Trump? Yeah.
You know, I mean, you've got Tiffany's, you know, father-in-law. He's the peace broker for Sudan. And golfing buddy is the realist. Yeah, whatever. I'm only being slightly facetious here.
No, you don't sound facetious at all. You're stating reality. What would be a smart international strategy at this point for the United States, for the West, given the nature of this regime and the nature of the humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan?
I mean, look, half of the population is dependent on food aid from the World Food Program for survival. You know, this is a country that's the poorest of the poor. Quite apart from the Taliban, this is a country that desperately needs assistance for its basic running costs. It seems to me that it would be wise for perhaps not the U.S. government, but maybe a group of other well-intended governments to get together and try to extract some concessions from the Taliban in terms of moderation with their own people in return for some kind of resumption of basic assistance and maybe access to credits, a lifting of sanctions so that they can begin to kind of re-enter the family of nations. I would personally want to see them make not just promissory, you know, rhetorical declarations of intent, but actual steps. Now, are they willing to do that? I'm not sure. We're talking about a group that has fought for a very long time. And Afghans, you know, Afghanistan is more of a battlefield than it's a nation in many ways. The Taliban, they're tough. And so are the Afghans. They live with very little, you know. If you asked, and this is kind of the truism that may for some people be a cliche, but if you ask an Afghan his age, they won't know usually because they don't celebrate birthdays. But usually if they hazard a guess, they're invariably 10 years older they look 10 years older than they are. So people who are in their mid-30s look in their late 40s or 50s even. They live tough lives. These are unleavened lives without comforts in a countryside that's very tough. And they can live close to the ground and often have. Now they're living close to the ground without war. so they can continue to live close to the ground. And I think that's probably the calculation of the Taliban leadership. You know, these are people who, you know, you throw a wool blanket and you lie on the ground and that's where you sleep for the night. If you're lucky, you get a piece of naan, a bread, and, you know, maybe a bit of an onion. I've lived with them. I know what it's like, you know. A bit of sheep fat, maybe once a week. So, you know, you're talking about a society that can go back to almost a kind of ground zero and subsist. Not the people of Kabul, unfortunately for them. That generation of, you know, Afghans that their hopes were raised by us, they were educated by us, they the world was open to us, and now they're stuck there. And that's those, for those people, and the people, of course, that worked with us and believed in us and somehow got trapped, left behind, I feel very sorry for them. And I think that the outside world, particularly the nations that belong to the NATO coalition, have a moral responsibility towards those people, at the very least. At the very least, you know.
Right.
Just as I think we did after Vietnam, really, you know. We should have demined that country and didn't for years. I think there was a period of time in which something like, I could be a little wrong, but thousands, if not 10,000 a year, Vietnamese were being either maimed or killed by mines left behind by the Americans. And until, I think, the Clinton era, refused to share the maps of those mines with them, where they could go and detect them and withdraw them. So the war continued in a kind of silent, terrible way after the war, after our withdrawal.
I mentioned before that this is the anniversary of the assassination of the father, the Lion of Panjshir, Ahmed Massoud's father. You've written quite a lot about that. When I asked him about it, he was 12 years old at the time. I'm talking about the son we just interviewed.
Yeah.
He says, there's no question in his mind, this was an operation ordered by bin Laden and Zawahiri and supported by the Pakistani ISI. Now, I know you've investigated Really?
Yeah. I have no reason to doubt what he says. Based on my investigation, I came in and watched the cities fall. And then I spent the spring of 2002 investigating the murder of Ahmed Shah Massoud. And I talked to almost everyone involved in the chain of people that allowed the Al-Qaeda guys to leave Kabul and cross into Northern Alliance territory, to all of them, right? Mm-hmm. And it's highly suspicious how they were allowed in. And they were allowed in by a putative ally of Massoud, who was himself the mentor of Osama bin Laden. But nonetheless, when the Taliban were in power, decided to ally himself with Massoud, and he controlled the access to the north. And when I interviewed him about why he had allowed these two guys in, he said, a friend from Bosnia suggested I let them in. They were journalists. They were supposedly Arab journalists. Well, really, they were Al-Qaeda guys. And they had come from one of bin Laden's camps and with this, the intention of killing Massoud. I found out from other people who know Sayaf, by the way, who's still there in Afghanistan.
And who is this character, Sayaf? Just tell us who he is.
Sayaf is a jihadi who fought against the Soviets, became extremely powerful, eventually was the closest ally, along with Haqqani, the father of the present interior minister, to Osama bin Laden. He sent, when Osama bin Laden was forced out of Sudan and back to Afghanistan in 1996, Sayaf had something to do with it. If Sayaf hadn't endorsed these two Arab journalists to come into Northern Alliance territory and travel towards Massoud, he wouldn't have been killed. And it was clearly timed with 9/11. Now, maybe they were off by a few days or whatever, but it's obvious that they were trying to get rid of the leader of the Northern Alliance when this huge event would happen. I don't think they could expect how the Americans would react. But what is also, what's true is that in the cities closest to the front line where Massoud was, the Al-Qaeda and Pakistani front, there were many Pakistanis there. There was Al-Qaeda Arabs and there were Taliban, launched a massive offensive the day, within hours of Massoud being, you know, bombed, killed. They tried to keep it secret for up to a week I would happen to be with his brother in London when they let him know that his brother had actually died. He was killed.
So that just suggests the Taliban was part of this conspiracy to assassinate Massoud.
Sure.
As well,
at right? some it's very high levels, yes.
Yeah. And the ISI?
Oh, the ISI have always, I mean, the ISI have been the mentors for the jihadis since. In the 1980s, I was driven to the front line where the Arabs were by an ISI agent from the city of Peshawar. And a Pakistani inner services intelligence agent drove me to a farm where the front line was, where they were fighting in those days against the Soviets. Right. And I had to leave a few days later because the Arabs came hunting for me. And the Afghans protected me and took me out. That was bin Laden's people. So, I mean, the ISI have always been involved in this. When the Taliban eventually are created and go against the Mujahideen who seize power in Kabul, they come out of Quetta, Pakistan. Look, ISI controls Pakistan. You know, it may operate on in it's kind of got a political state, you know, the Imran Khan, the Benazir Bhutto state that seems to be vulnerable to that other state, the one controlled by the Pakistani military and its jihadists within ISI, one of whom, Gul, who's now dead, bragged about his relationship with Osama bin Laden. They were providing the rat line for Al-Qaeda and the other groups that joined them from Central Asia from the time the Americans came into the country in 2001. We saw them surrender and then they disappeared, and we knew that they were being brought into the tribal territories of Pakistan under the protection of ISI. And it was from there throughout most of the Americans' tenure in Afghanistan that the worst attacks were launched against the Americans and their allies, you know. And lo and behold, by the Haqqani network, who now control right. Kabul, you know.
So no question in your mind that
None.
The assassination None. And 9/11 were all part of the same operation?
I have no question, no doubt about it. Hmm. I never found any evidence to the contrary.
Yeah. So the state of play today, first of all, I mean, when Zawahiri was assassinated by the United States a year or so ago, he was in Kabul.
Mm-hmm.
So is there still a meaningful Al-Qaeda presence in Afghanistan being protected by the Taliban?
Well, he was in a Haqqani safe house.
Yeah.
You know? They claim to have rescinded their ties. Clearly, they hadn't. Look, what is Al Qaeda today, right? In the era of ISIS, what is Al Qaeda? It's like talking about, I don't know, Sinn Fein to the IRA, right? Or I don't know. That's not the right. best example, but you know what I mean. So what's happened now is you've got, you know, Al Qaeda has become the establishment. And ISIS are the young wild tearaways. So you now have a Taliban, the Frankenstein of the Taliban and Al Qaeda is ISIS, ISIS Khorasan. And they attack the Taliban and they attack, of course, Shiites because they regard them as apostates and most Taliban mm-hmm. are Sunni. And they attack the Hazara, who are Shiites, this ethnic group that look Mongol. And they attack girls' schools and bomb them and kill them. Because they're ISIS, right? But who are they? Who were they originally? Taliban, who feel like these Taliban, the ones who now control the country, have gone soft.
Yeah.
So, you know, this is a story that just keeps tumbling forward. Are they strong? We don't know. There's also a Pakistani Taliban, which is a kind of godchild of the Haqqani network, and right from their time in the tribal territories, that are attacking Pakistan. And the Pakistanis are now, you know, throwing out their Afghan refugees as a consequence of that. And there's a lot of tension between the Taliban leadership and the Pakistanis because you've got a Pakistani Taliban that's attacking the Pakistanis. They want Pakistan to be a true Khalifat, not just like this, you know, the Pakistanis, they would say, put on a good show of being real Muslims, but they're not. So it's kind of a mess.
When, to say the least, when Biden made the decision to pull out, the testimony from administration officials is, well, we'll still be able to keep an eye on what these terror groups are up to with overflights, with drones, with satellites, and we'll be able to take care of any attacks that might be in the planning stages. Was that just words to pacify Democrats getting criticized for what Biden was doing, or is there any reality to that?
You know, I mean, look, it's happened on Biden's watch, so he owns it, right? But in fact, it was Trump that opened the door to the Taliban coming back. He told them he wanted out. He basically made a deal, and it happened under Biden's watch. Should Biden have taken Trump's deal and not reneged? I personally disagree with Biden's choice. I mean, we saw what happened in Kabul. It was every bit as traumatic as Saigon, right? If not worse in some ways. People falling off the aircraft, the horrors of that, those people trying to leave, all the people that got left behind. So, and handing back a country to the very people you'd been fighting for 20 years. I don't know when that's been done. You know what I mean? So, So do we have overwatch? I think we do have some. We hear, and you would know this even better than I, Mike, with your knowledge of what's happening in the kind of national security arena. When those Tajik ISIS guys bombed that nightclub in Moscow, was it 2 years ago, a year and a half ago, and killed all those people? And also those kind of suicide commandos. Apparently the CIA warned Putin that this was going to happen. So it means they have some knowledge. And that's Tajikistan, just on the border, northern border. And that's apparently an ISIS sump now. So, you know, it can't be unrelated to what's happened in Afghanistan.
Right. But we don't know if that was an NSA intercept or there's sources on the ground or who knows.
No. And the fact of the matter is, and I know there's people in the security business who would agree, is that if we had left a kind of a core of 10,000 men who we weren't doing combat in the last few years. We didn't have any American casualties for the last few years. But if we'd left a sort of core of 10,000 men to, you know, provide the kind of intel, the big tech, the arms deliveries, the oversight on the aviation and all that, you know, the Taliban probably would not have come back to power. It was psychological. Once they knew we were leaving, they started putting pressure on the Afghans who were supposed to do the fighting. The Afghans who were supposed to do the fighting realized the Americans didn't have their backs, and they started cutting deals. And one city after the other began to fall. If we had had their backs, they would not have done that. Right. So, right. You know, we have 30,000 men in South Korea. How many years have we had them there? 70?
Yep.
What would it have cost it to keep 10,000 in Afghanistan?
Good question. Well, John, I want to thank you for a really helpful discussion. We wanted to have a reality check on where things are, and you have fulfilled our wish entirely. The book is To Lose a War, The Fall and Rise of the Taliban by John Lee Anderson. Thanks for joining
us. Thanks a lot, Mike. Real pleasure.
And that's it for this week's Spy Talk. Be sure to check out our complete podcast archive on Apple or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you haven't already, do check out the spytalk.co news site on Substack, where we offer a steady diet of scoops and original analyses on the intersection of intelligence, foreign policy, and military operations. Just Google Spy Talk and you'll quickly find your way there. This edition of the Spy Talk podcast was smoothly produced, as always, by Kanai, and expertly edited by Molly Hawkey for MSW Media. That's it. See you around. I'm Michael Isikoff. Thanks for listening.
For more original reporting and insights like this, subscribe to spytalk.co on Substack and follow us on Twitter at @talk_spy. If you enjoyed our podcast, subscribe and leave a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
MSW Media.
I'm Brian Karam, and I've spent decades covering politics. Now I'm taking you behind the scenes, one interview at a time.
Join us as each week Brian confronts the issues that matter, posing the questions you wish you could ask. No filter, no agenda, just the truth.
We're not here for sound bites. We're here for substance. Join me, Brian Karam, every week as we cut through the noise and get straight to it. This is Just Ask the Question, where curiosity will lead us to the facts.
Subscribe now on your favorite podcast platform. And remember, when you want answers, all you have to do is just ask the question.